Let's talk about your music, in fact, because you have been involved in electronic space music for quite some time. And at the core of your music is the synthesizer. I was wondering if you could talk about your relationship with that instrument and how it has progressed over the years.
Well, initially, I would say I was more primarily involved with the studio as the synthesizer. This was kind of back in the days before you could run out and buy a Mini Moog. I would create different tape loops going on different tape machines, and some of them were ambient things I'd recorded. Some of them were experiments I'd done with electric guitars and organs, and I would mix everything together in a very crude way, technologically, to synthesize something new out of that. And then, along with the invention of the actual physical synthesizers, with Bob Moog's, I guess the Mini Moog was the first synthesizer I actually owned. Then it became more formal synthesis as we know it today, or as we know it as the roots of synthesis today. And from there, it kind of grew into, I guess, the height of that period, which was analog synthesis, was working with the Serge synthesizer and working with the large modular Serge system. And then it kind of moved from that back into the studio as synthesizer again. Probably that happened right around the time that I scored Baraka, where I wasn't so much interested in an individual instrument as a synthesizer as I was how the entire studio could kind of orchestrate together to synthesize new things. And these days I'm really kind of still in that realm. I've got I do have kind of formal synthesizers and some neat new ones that are actually software driven, where you have a synthesizer that's running on a computer as part of the mix, the gumbo. And then, of course, there are our regular hardwired synthesizers and samplers. Sampling is still probably the most fundamental process that I use in my music at the moment.
Well, you've been working with this instrument for so many years. Do you think you'll ever feel that you've come to the end of the possibilities with it?
Oh, I don't think we'll ever exhaust the end of those possibilities. Those will continue to be explored long after I'm gone from this planet.
Well, along with, you had mentioned the Serge modular, and I'm not quite clear on, I understand that you used it on your earlier albums, but I wasn't sure if you still have one to this day. And maybe you could explain a little bit about that to our audience, who might not have so much insight into all the different, into the nature of so many different brands and styles of synthesizers.
Right. Well, the Serge Modular is a synthesizer that's made up of modules, just as the name says, and there are panels, and each panel can hold a number of modules on it. And the thing that makes the Serge unique is that the owner of the Serge can actually, when you specify how you want the panels delivered to you, you can actually specify the order and placement of the modules on the panel. So it really is customized to the way that you think about synthesis and creating music electronically, or at least analog synthesis. And so that makes it a very unique kind of modular analog synthesizer. The different modules are, you know, things like oscillators or things that create sounds, and then there are modules that modify the sounds, and modules that actually process the sounds, and modules that distribute the sound through the studio. And then there are other kinds of modules which control those modules, And they can all feed back into each other so that you can have very complex feedback loops going on. And that kind of describes any modular synthesizer. What makes the Serge so unique is that it's a customized environment to the way that the owner kind of thinks about working in analog synthesis.
Has that been a constant throughout your music career, or have you drifted back and forth between using it and not using it?
Yeah, right now I don't actually own one, but I have access to one. And the last time that I really worked very specifically with the Serge in that way, where I created a piece that was 100% Serge, was I guess it was about 3 or 4 years ago on my CD Within the Nine Dimensions. There's a piece on there called Seven, which I did entirely on the Serge synthesizer. But most of the time, in terms of my compositional process and the instruments that I use for the unfolding of that, I use samplers, and they're not even kind of the newest generation samplers. They're samplers that are 5 or 6 or 7 or 8 years old at this point. I think one of my samplers I've been using since I did Baraka, which was 1991 and 1992, so it's over 10 years old.
So along with the electronic aspect of your music, as far as I can tell, listening to or being familiar with all of your work, I would say that you also incorporate acoustic sounds and instruments, and quite uniquely, I would say. And I'd like you to speak about some of the acoustic instruments that you've used. Some of them are quite astounding and unconventional.
Well, I've been really lucky and blessed with running into people who are interested in innovating, astounding, and unique acoustic instruments. Let's see, some of the ones I've worked with. I worked with George Landry, actually in the design phase and building of his instrument, Lyra Sound Constellation, which was a huge, I guess the closest thing you could see it as would be a harp. It was a stringed instrument with 156 strings tuned microtonally, and the strings stretched from large discs on the floor all the way up to the ceiling. Some of the strings were over 30 feet long. And one could play the instrument, or I should say one had to play the instrument by moving through it, because it was also 36 feet across and about 24 feet wide, so you would actually move through the strings and play them. And you could play them either in the conventional way that you would play a stringed instrument by plucking it, or you could strike the strings with mallets, or actually the most unique way to play that instrument was to actually pull on the strings and let your fingers slide over the string and the piano wire, and that would create a really interesting sound, almost like a horn. And then one instrument that I still have in my possession, which I still use a lot to this day, is something called the Beam, which was designed by a fellow by the name of John Lazell. And there are other people that have the Beam. If you want one, you have to make one yourself. So I made mine. It's a extruded miner made out of extruded aluminum. And the one sitting next to me here in the studio actually is about 12 feet long. And it has 24 strings or piano wire, gauged 19 through 22 gauge. And the Beam is played by, again, either by striking it or... I have some stainless steel dowels which I use to fret the instrument and slide along the strings, kind of like a pedal steel guitar player would do. And I've also been really blessed to have in my life a dear friend by the name of Irv Wilson, who not only designs instruments, but he also designs the tuning systems on which the instruments are based. And Irv's quite a guy. He designed and built the Icosony. I think when the show, or at least as I was waiting to come on the show, the piece that you were playing was done on the eikosiny. And the eikosiny is a set of vibes, or it's a vibe-like instrument, but the bars are tuned to a microtonal series, which is called the eikosiny, actually, that was designed by, this particular set was designed by Irv.
Now, you've also gone on location to record sounds and bring them back to the studio and manipulate them as well.
Yeah, that's one of the things I've done, gosh, I think throughout my career. Going all the way back to, I guess, Morning Jewel in 1979, I always try to travel with, these days it's a DAT machine. In those days it was a high-quality cassette recorder with some studio stereo mics. And to me, it's just a lot of fun to go out into the world, and particularly into environments that other people wouldn't have a chance to get to, whether it's the side of a volcano in Indonesia or the rainforests in Costa Rica or Brazil. And then it's really fun to go out like at 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning, or stay out all night long and make recordings of these environments, bring them back to the studio. Most recently, I've been doing quite a bit of underwater recording. My former wife was a underwater photographer, and I got to do a lot of scuba diving, hanging out with her, and some of the places that we would travel to, I realized there was a whole world of sound there that I couldn't record because I didn't have a hydrophone. So I built a couple of hydrophones, and this was about 5 or 6 years ago, and I've really gotten involved in and been enjoying recording underwater environments. It's just a whole other soundscape underneath the water.
And what about what is referred to around here as ringing rocks? But I think you have an album where you call them singing stones. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah. I think I was first turned on to that phenomena in about 1992. A friend of mine in Utah faxed me an article from a local newspaper up there about these ringing rocks or singing stones. I was just fascinated by it, that there were these rocks that when struck would ring like bells or chimes or gongs. And I did a little bit of research and discovered that, you know, that the roots of it and some of the first or some of the oldest ones that have been discovered are actually in Africa. And I had this sense that I really wanted to do a recording, a Michael Stearns recording, utilizing those ringing rocks. There was just something about it that I really caught my attention. So in 1994, I found myself with a chunk of time. I think I had about 3 months, and I decided I was going to focus on that, and I began trying to do research on some of the sites here in the southwestern United States. And I kept running into problems because many of the sites are on Native American land, and I don't have a Native American name, so the doors just kind of were slammed in my face. And it occurred to me to talk with my good friend Ron Sunsinger and see if he might be interested in participating in the project with me. So I gave Ron a call and gave him my notes, and within 48 hours he had it was like 22 pages of notes and permission to already granted to go into some of these places and record. And so about a month later, he and I piled into my Explorer and we took off, and we went to sites here in New Mexico and in Arizona and in Southern California primarily, and recorded the rocks over about, I think we were out on the road for about a month, 5 weeks, something like that. And then we came back to my studio in Santa Fe. At that time, it was out on Apache Ridge and just hunkered down in the studio for a few weeks and put together the Singing Stones CD release.
So how do you incorporate these sounds that are, I guess some of them are musical, but how do you create an album, a synthesis of music out of these raw sources that you've recorded and or the things that you play? Like, do you get excited about the sound and then create a piece from that, or do you have like a vision for what you're going to do and you're out searching for the sound to fulfill the vision?
Well, it's both, Chuck. Sometimes, for instance, on the Singing Stones release, I kind of had a vision of this release that I wanted to do, and that got me started. And then once we started recording these amazing sounds, musical, they're really rocks which resonate so beautifully musically because they're something about the matrix of the stone within them that, you know, Ron and I, we'd hit one of these rocks and we'd just look at each other dumbfounded because the sound was so amazing. And I had some pickups which I had developed to actually take to Indonesia when I was climbing into volcanoes for an IMAX project that I had been scoring and producing the soundtrack to. And we discovered that if you put one of these pickups on the rock, it would pick up the sound of the ringing directly, so that if there was any other noise in the vicinity, in which you couldn't use a microphone, that you could just record the rocks directly. And when we brought those back to the studio, some of the sounds, I remember there was one sound in particular, which was when we would rub the rocks, not strike them with something, but actually rub the surface of the rocks, and then sometimes one rock would be touching another rock, and the resonance would travel from one rock as it started to resonate, sort of like taking your finger and wetting it and running it around the lip of a crystal wine goblet. That resonance would actually travel through into another rock. And when I heard those, there were just these sound worlds that were revealed in these recordings that we made, and that was really the inspiration for the pieces. Really came out of the kind of the wonder and the awe and the joy of discovery of those sounds. And sometimes I have pieces that come to me kind of fully formed in dreams, and it's all I can do to get up in the morning and sit down and churn it out. So there's really no one way that this process of composition for myself happens. It kind of comes in many different ways.
Well, what is your orientation towards live performance? Like, what does it do for you as an artist?
Well, I try and do something. I don't do it often, once every couple of years, and I try and approach it differently every time I go out. Since it's not it's not about making money, it's about kind of exploring who I am and how I interact with people and whatever that unfolding is, the dynamic between the two. The last time it was more of a recapitulation of a lot of things that I had been working on and had already published. At least I don't remember whether I performed anything new or not. This time out, I'm doing something very different from the last time out, which is that I'm primarily, although not exclusively, working with visual material. I realized about 3 or 4 years ago that I had been scoring these films for these amazing visual artists and spending a lot of time with them, both in the studio working on the music for the projects, and I've been really lucky that a number of them have invited me to actually travel with them when they go out and shoot in the world. And it's great because I come up with ideas, or I'm listening to something and I can just lean over in an airplane or in a bus or in a truck or whatever, if I'm traveling with somebody like Ron Fricke, and throw the headphones on his head so that he can get a sense of what I'm thinking about already, compositionally or texturally, in in terms of the music for the project we might be working on. And anyway, about 3 years ago, I realized that I've been working with all these great people, and that I was being challenged by them, or taking some of it on through osmosis, and that I really wanted to start working with my own visuals and also working with other people's visuals, but treating them editorially, perhaps in a way that would be different from the way they would treat them. So I've been kind of working on that in the background for a number of years now, about 3 years, and this time out I've put together a number of pieces. Some of them are new, some of them are the pieces that I've already composed that are visually based. In other words, it's not meant to be just a musical journey, but it's more, or at least I'm thinking about it more in the way that I think about scoring film. It's actually music created to picture, or picture that was treated editorially to music that I had already composed. So this is a new thing for me. There will be a screen at the concert, and the visuals would be projected on the screen while I'm playing live to them.
Yeah, I should mention that once again that you are coming to Philadelphia to play live on Saturday, October 4th at 8 p.m. in the reverberant space of St. Mary's Hamilton Village. That's in the church sanctuary of that church. That's at 3916 Locust Walk on the Penn campus in West Philadelphia. And for details about that concert, you can access their website at www.thegatherings.org. And Michael Stearns is also playing at the E-Live Day-Long Festival in Holland. That's happening on Saturday, September 27th, 2003. And for details about that event, you can access their website at www.groove.nl. How do you manage time between your film work and your album releases? What is it, since you don't come out to play live all that much, what is it that gets you to a point where you are coming out to play live, like internally, personally?
Well, there's usually something that triggers the whole thing. In this case, it was an email from Ron Boots over in the Netherlands saying, would you be interested in headlining the E-Live Festival this year? And it seems like when something like that happens, a lot of things just fall into place. I mean, the next thing I knew, there was an email from Chuck Van Zyl.
Oh, there you go.
And this has been a very interesting and challenging year for me, and particularly in the balance in balancing my life and time that I spend with music, and family. And it's been a year of a lot of major transitions for me, a year in which I thought I was going to have 6 months to work on this concertizing in the background while I worked on commercial projects in the foreground. And as it turned out, the universe had other ideas about the timing of all of it. And I've been through a divorce this year, and sold a home, and found a new studio, and moved into the new studio, although I'm still living out of boxes, and finished a couple of major IMAX film projects. Got to go up to Lucas Valley and mix the film up there. It was the first time I'd been able to go up to George's facility to actually mix a film. And it's been quite a year. I'm actually exhausted. I think when I get back from this outing, performing at E-Live and then at the Gathering with you in Philadelphia, I'm going to go to bed for about a week.
Your music from, especially the early music, when sort of was kind of undefined, and the genre really was not all that well defined when you first began, and you are associated with the core of the genre of space music, and also in certain respects with New Age music as well. But it was always music that was about the future, and in a way, you were trying to define the 21st century back in 1980. But now we're in the 21st century, and I wondered how you felt about that, about the where the music stands right now in relationship to the world.
Well, music for myself has always been, I have kind of a unique view about music, or I guess about any art, in that, or let's put it this way, any form of expression. In that I've always felt that the real art is what it means to be human and how we stretch ourselves and explore as human beings. So music to me is kind of a hieroglyphic or a metaphor for that process of the human as a work of art, or human beings as works of art, and are participating together as art. So I've never really thought about it as music of the future or of the past, or it's always been the music in the moment for me, which I guess is why I find it hard to go back and listen to music that I've already created, because I seem to always be onto something different or something new in my own explorations as a human, and then the way that unfolds through me as formal music, or proto music, as some people call it. You can see as I listen to the music here in New Mexico. I mean, we have a pretty eclectic smorgy of music here. We've got everything from electronica to Native American singing. Because we're in the heart of the Pueblo Indians here, there are a number of weekly programs that are dedicated to Native American singing, and we have a full-time jazz station and a full-time classical station. So, I feel like when I'm sitting in my car and I'm pushing buttons on the radio and tuning into each of these, it's like traveling in space and time. And being immersed in different ways of thinking and being and creating, and I guess for myself, I've been driven to make the music that I make, and so it's not I don't really see it as a music. If anything, it's a music of memories which are not attached to the future or the past. They're just floating through me. And so that's it. It's not. I don't really get a sense of its future music. The music that I hear today, which is considered future music, I would guess, is just the music of the culture as it's unfolding today. And that's kind of a different zone than the music that I do or someone like Steve Roach does, where it's really more in a timeless space. It's not about a cultural past, present, or future.